Today's critique examines an essay arguing for reparatory justice by dismantling the concept of colonial debt reversal and reframing reparations as the restoration of life capacity through institutional responsibility.
Yeah, and the foundational argument here is just incredibly strong, so I think let's dive directly into how we can make this material truly bulletproof against likely objections.
Absolutely. So, kicking things off, the essay's distinction between inherited personal guilt and continuous institutional responsibility is brilliantly articulated, but it kind of bypasses the historical friction of how institutions actually mutate over centuries.
Right, and that vulnerability is, it's going to be the very first thing a skeptical historian or economist attacks, you know?
Oh, for sure. Because, I mean, the material makes this really compelling conceptual case that a modern citizen obviously doesn't inherit the personal guilt of, like, an 18th century plantation owner.
Exactly. But it argues that continuing bodies, so your states, banks, universities, they absolutely do inherit the wealth and the obligations.
Right. But the weakness here is that the argument treats institutional continuity as this seamless, easily identifiable line.
Yeah, it's too neat. By not addressing the messy reality of institutional mutation, I mean the endless mergers, regime changes, bankruptcies, rebranding, the paper leaves itself wide open to objections.
Because critics are just going to try to use the immense complexity of corporate history to void the liability entirely, right?
Totally. They'll look at the chaotic history of any institution and say, well, the thread is broken.
Looky actually throw an analogy at that just to see how a critic might try to dismantle the framing.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so imagine a maritime insurance firm from, say, 1820, right? And they heavily insured slave ships and colonial trading vessels.
Okay.
But over two centuries, that original firm is dissolved. Its assets are absorbed by a regional bank in the 1880s. Then that bank gets nationalized during a war. Later, it's reprivatized, and eventually it's spun off into this massive, modern, digital financial conglomerate.
Right, a totally unrecognizable entity today.
Exactly. So how do we prevent a critic from pointing to a dissolved charter from 1880 and arguing that the institutional thread has just been irrevocably broken?
I mean, they will make that exact argument. They'll rely entirely on the assumption that legal dissolution equals moral and financial absolution.
Right. Like, the company's gone, so the debt is gone.
Exactly. So the suggestion to fix this is to fortify the conceptual framework by establishing that reparatory liability tracks the flow of capital and systemic advantage, not just the name on the building.
Ah, okay. So following the money, basically.
Exactly. The author needs to actively shift the focus from the legal shell of the institution to its actual economic substance.
Which means we need to explain how capital fungibility operates across all these centuries.
Yeah. So we introduce a concrete historical example of a complex institutional lineage just to preempt this counterargument before the critic can even make it.
So what's a good example they could use?
Well, you could explicitly mention the British Emancipation Settlement of the 1830s.
Oh, right. Where they paid out, what, 20 million pounds?
Yeah, 20 million pounds. But crucially, that compensation was paid to the slave owners, not the enslaved.
Right, right.
So show the reader where that massive injection of capital actually went. Detail how it wasn't just, you know, stuffed in mattresses.
It was reinvested.
Heavily reinvested. It capitalized the Victorian railway boom. It funded specific banking mergers that literally formed the bedrock of modern international finance.
Wow, okay. So by following the money into the railways, you demonstrate that the original capital didn't just evaporate when the plantation system ended.
Exactly. It compounded. I mean, it bought steel, it bought land, laid tracks, generated new dividends for entirely new shareholders.
So the liability carries forward because the systemic advantage carried forward.
Yes. The bank from 1790 merging into a multinational in 1990 is just a change of clothing for the exact same foundational wealth.
I love that phrasing, a change of clothing. It really frames the issue perfectly for the reader and closes that massive loophole.
Yeah, it completely nullifies the defense of, we changed our logo, therefore our debts are erased.
Right. It forces them to look at the continuous river of wealth rather than just the changing names of the boats floating on it.
Exactly. Now, moving on to the next point, building on the need to maintain an ironclad, evidence-based defense against these institutional critics, we really need to look at the tone in the middle of the essay.
Yeah, because we want to ensure the language doesn't give those same critics an easy out.
Right.
And the introduction of Moloch and Mammon creates this sudden rhetorical shift that temporarily unmoors the essay from its precise socioeconomic foundation.
I noticed that jarring transition too. It really stood out.
Does introducing ancient deities of sacrifice and wealth risk diluting the incredibly grounded legal economic argument we just built about falsified balance sheets?
I mean, yes, that is the exact weakness here. The essay relies so heavily on rigorous frameworks, balance sheets, liability, capacity restoration.
And then suddenly we're talking about ancient gods.
Right, it feels totally tonally disjointed. It risks giving skeptical readers a really convenient excuse to dismiss the whole argument.
Like they'll just say it's poetic or dramatic rather than empirical.
Exactly. It acts as an escape hatch for the opposition.
Because if a critic can't defeat the rigorous accounting, they'll just attack the rhetoric surrounding it.
Yeah, they'll point to Moloch and say, well, this isn't an economic paper, it's just a moralistic sermon. We don't need to take these financial claims seriously.
Which is frustrating, because the underlying concept the author is trying to convey is incredibly potent.
It really is. The idea that colonialism fundamentally required human sacrifice to generate this detached, abstracted wealth, that is a necessary point.
So we definitely don't want to lose the impact of that idea.
No, absolutely not. We want to preserve the gravity of the moral argument, but we have to change the delivery mechanism.
Okay, so what's the suggestion here?
Evolve the metaphor by anchoring these archetypes explicitly in the historical accounting ledgers and legal doctrines of the era, completely refusing to let them exist merely as abstract literary devices.
Oh, I see. Grounding the mythology directly into the paperwork?
Exactly. Fuse the two together.
You know, to put that into practice, I keep thinking about the actual administrative documents of that era. Like if Parliament authorized compensation for slave owners.
Yeah?
Then that legislative authorization document itself is the altar of Moloch, isn't it?
Yes, that is a phenomenal way to reframe it.
Right? It isn't a literal demon sitting in a fiery pit. It is a bureaucrat's signature on a piece of vellum.
Exactly. And for a concrete example, instead of broadly stating, you know, Moloch received the sacrifice, the author could tie this directly to an 18th century plantation inventory ledger.
Oh, where human beings are literally depreciated on a balance sheet.
Right alongside cattle and machinery. They can explicitly frame that specific ledger as the altar.
Man, a ledger reducing a human being to a fraction of a pound sterling is honestly infinitely more horrifying than a mythological beast.
Because the ledger actually existed.
Exactly. It takes this abstract concept of a demon demanding sacrifice and makes it terrifyingly, undeniably real.
And the reader's psychological response to a real historical document quantifying human suffering is going to be so much stronger than just a biblical allusion.
So much stronger. Alternatively, they could even replace the deities entirely with the actual historical actors mentioned earlier, right?
Yeah, they could lean into the intertwined structure of state power, commerce, and finance.
Like referring to the altar of imperial commerce.
Or the machinery of the plantation economy. Using the specific terminology of the era maintains that piercing, grounded institutional focus.
Yeah, it keeps the reader's feet planted firmly inside the courtroom and the bank vault.
Which is exactly where this argument is actually being won.
Absolutely. Okay, so once we have secured the historical ledger and maintained our empirical tone, the final step is ensuring the proposed future solutions are mathematically tied to the historical harms we've just proved.
Right, the solutions section.
The proposed reparatory commons offer a highly constructive vision for the future, but the causal bridge connecting specific historical colonial extractions to these modern regional solutions feels, honestly, incomplete.
Yeah, this brings us to the essay's core confrontation with colonial debt reversal. And the author does an exceptional job dismantling that insidious argument that former colonies owe a debt to colonizers for, like, railways or ports.
Right, proving that infrastructure was built exclusively for extraction, not local development.
Exactly. But the weakness emerges when the essay pivots to its own solutions, the transition from the diagnosis of the falsified balance sheet to the proposed reparatory commons lacks a direct, explicit mapping.
Let me play devil's advocate here to show how a reader might misinterpret this.
Okay, hit me.
So we are proposing climate-resilient systems and regional pharmaceutical institutions as reparations.
Right.
How do we ensure a skeptical reader doesn't just view this as a standard modern international development wish list rather than a direct payment of a specific debt?
That is the exact risk. a reader might fail to see how current climate vulnerability is the direct structural result of colonial extraction.
Right. They might just see it as generic challenges that any developing nation faces today.
Exactly. If you just state, we need climate-resilient agriculture, the critic will simply reply, well, climate change affects everyone. This is just a request for foreign aid.
It has nothing to do with 18th century imperialism.
Right. And that disconnect threatens to dilute the entire premise of the essay. If these commons are viewed as discretionary foreign aid, the argument fails.
So how do we fix that?
The suggestion is to explicitly map the specific capacities diminished by colonialism directly to the specific repertory commons proposed, turning the modern solutions into undeniable one-to-one historical corrections.
Okay, so we really have to show the math of the historical injury to justify the math of the modern repair.
Yes, we have to prove absolute causality.
Showing that math requires diving deep into the actual mechanics of colonial extraction, I assume.
Definitely. Let's look at the proposal for ecological restoration trusts as a concrete example.
Okay.
The author needs a transitional paragraph linking the historical monocrop plantation economy directly to modern ecological crises.
Right. We can't just say colonialism was bad for the environment.
No, you have to explain how centuries of forced sugarcane cultivation operated mechanistically.
Like exploring the agricultural reality of mercantilism?
Exactly. Explain how colonial powers clear-cut ancient forests to maximize arable land for cash crops, which fundamentally altered the Caribbean landscape.
And planting sugarcane year after year without crop rotation just entirely depleted the soil nutrients, right?
Depleted the soil and completely destroyed indigenous biodiversity. Plus, elaborate on how imperial economic design forbade colonies from growing their own subsistence crops.
Oh, so they were forced to rely on imported food?
Yeah, imported salted cod and flour from the imperial center.
Wow. So by detailing that specific economic mechanism, you connect historical agricultural extraction directly to modern soil degradation and modern food import dependency.
Exactly. It proves that the current extreme climate vulnerability of these regions wasn't an accident of geography.
It was an engineered feature of imperial economic design.
Right. So when a hurricane hits an island today, the devastation is magnified because the island's natural ecological defenses and economic resilience were deliberately stripped away centuries ago.
Just to enrich a foreign capital.
Yes. And that is exactly how you justify the proposed ecological restoration trusts. By tightening that causal bridge, you prove to the reader that a trust isn't a generic environmental charity program.
It is a highly specific, calculated repair for a specific, documented colonial action.
Precisely. The essay already does the hard work of proving the debt exists. It just needs to show the receipt for why this specific payment is required.
That makes so much sense. And we can apply that exact same methodology to the other proposals on the author's list, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, let's take the proposed Caribbean Research Institutes and regional pharmaceutical labs. How does the author prove those are mandatory acts of reparatory justice, rather than just, you know, a nice idea for modern development?
The author must connect it to the historical suppression of autonomous colonial education.
Right, because imperial centers deliberately withheld scientific and medical training.
Exactly. They wanted to maintain a dependent, unskilled labor force. But at the same time, colonial powers actively extracted immense botanical and medicinal knowledge from indigenous and enslaved populations.
Oh, like the extraction of cinchona bark for quinine?
Yes, perfect example. They extracted the knowledge, but simultaneously forbade the establishment of local scientific institutions that could capitalize on that knowledge.
Wow, so the deficit in modern institutional capacity was a deliberate policy choice, not just a natural developmental lag?
Exactly. By explaining the mechanics of that intellectual suppression, the author proves that building a regional pharmaceutical lab today is a direct restoration of the exact intellectual and scientific capacity that was intentionally stunted on the falsified balance sheet.
You prove the institution isn't a gift, it is a refund.
Yes, a refund. And by applying this rigorous mapping to every single item on the repertory commons list, the author transforms these proposals from hopeful aspirations into a rigorous, non-negotiable invoice for stolen capacity.
It really leaves the critic with absolutely nowhere to hide.
Nowhere. They can no longer hide behind the myth of colonial debt reversal, because the SA has meticulously proven that the infrastructure of empire was designed solely to extract life capacity.
And the reparatory commons are the exact mathematical inverse required to restore it.
Exactly.
This piece provides a truly vital paradigm-shifting framework for looking at reparatory justice. I mean, it moves us past the dead-end arguments of inherited personal guilt and forces us to look at the cold, hard machinery of systemic advantage.
It really does. It's a fantastic piece of work.
So, just a recap for the author. Strengthening this material will involve a few targeted structural reinforcements. First, addressing the complexities of institutional mutation by tracking the flow of capital, like the British Emancipation Compensation, to close loopholes on corporate liability.
Right.
Second, grounding the metaphors of Moloch and Mammon firmly in historical ledgers and legal documents to maintain a piercing, empirical tone that denies critics an easy escape hatch.
Yeah, fusing the mythology to the paperwork.
Exactly. And finally, explicitly mapping the mechanisms of specific historical extractions, like soil depletion from monocropping and the suppression of education, directly to the proposed reparatory commons to prove they are structural corrections, not just modern development goals.
The foundational logic the author has built here is already incredibly robust. Applying these specific causal reinforcements will make the argument airtight.
It really will.
It forces the conversation out of the realm of abstract morality and anchors it exactly where it belongs, in the historical ledgers and the continuous flow of capital.
Totally, because when you finally force a system to record its invisible costs, when you drag the human and ecological toll out of the margins and write it directly into the ledger with precise, undeniable causality, the old math of empire collapses entirely.
Beautifully said.
The question is no longer who theoretically owes a debt, but how we practically and mathematically begin to balance the book of life. We highly encourage the author to take these actionable steps and submit the revised material back in for another critique.